Thanks for listening to the Lunch and Learn with Dr. Barry, here to help educate, motivate, and put you on the right path to take control of your health through weekly discussions on topics in the medical field, public health arena, and in your community. And now your host, Dr. Barry.
All right, welcome to another episode of Medicine Mondays. I have a special guest for you who is going to be talking about the aspect of having a non-clinical career. And obviously, if you've been following me, Lunch and Learn listeners, Medicine Monday watchers, you know that I like to focus on things that don't necessarily have to do with medicine. But more importantly, I love my docs who like to explore, right? I think traditionally, we always think about this aspect of, oh, you become a doctor, you gotta see patients in the office, and they clock in, clock out, and there's so many different options. But Dr. Dooley, first of all, thank you for taking the time out to bless Lunch and Learn community with your presence. Can you give a little bit introduction on yourself, just in case, you know, they don't know who you are, and then we'll get into the nitty gritty.
Sure. I'm Dr. Leanne Dooley. I'm a board certified psychiatrist. And after being in clinical practice about 11 years, I transitioned to a non-clinical career almost exactly a year ago. But I'm a generalist by training. A lot of my clinical time I was spent working in the VA hospital system, working with veterans. So it's kind of a little bit about my clinical experience there.
Now, and you talked about a year ago, kind of, I don't want to call it breaking away, because may not have been a break, might have been a push, but just that split. Was there any event, or was this something that over that decade of time of kind of going the traditional route that you say, you know what, I feel like I want to do something different?
Yeah, I think actually around 2019, that's really when I was first getting the inkling that, okay, I know that I want to have a transition. I actually around that time started taking some classes toward a master's degree in public health. I really thought that that was the trajectory that my career was going. Okay. I actually left the VA hospital for a short period of time at the end of 2019, going to academia with the idea of kind of moving into some teaching as it relates to public health. Within 2020 came, and so that, and then, you know, we all know what happened then.
We know what happened in 2020 for sure.
Exactly. So, you know, that was kind of short lived, that time in academia, that the position just didn't pan out to be anything, you know, like I left there for. But I really honestly was just getting to the point where I knew that I wanted to do something different. I knew I wanted to be something non-clinical. I've kind of pivoted from, I guess, more traditional public health at this point. But that was kind of where I started with that.
Now, again, I have a master's and I ended up getting a dual degree as well, PH and a DO. And I tell people all the time that the public health degree just kind of put this different hat on me, that even as I was practicing medicine, like it was sometimes overpowering that I said, oh, you know what, you gotta, like, yeah, the medicine way may think that's okay, but the public health, it was just a different thought. And I always harken back to the fact that the reason why I even started getting on social media is that I start feeling obligated to speak to the public and feeling like I wasn't doing enough, just kind of having the one-on-one patient interaction, because I knew how many people and how many groups of people and how many systems were actually affected. So I'm interested that public health was something that kind of put the light bulb in and made you start going that direction before the unfortunate pivot in 2020.
Exactly. And I think being in the VA hospital system so long and being in a huge bureaucratic federal system and really seeing how not understanding how to navigate the systems and how it worked at the higher level. I mean, I think my concentration was policy and management. I think for that reason, the experience in the VA, because there's so much in the area of policy, government, politics that drive things that happen in the Veterans Administration that really have nothing to do with like day-to-day care of a patient. Mm-hmm.
And can you talk a little bit about, because I know I've interviewed a few people, and I've taken care of quite a few veterans, as far as what is it like when you're practicing within the VA system? Like, I tell people, it's just like unless you're in the system, it's very difficult to kind of explain like how that process even works. And that I'm in West Palm Beach, so we have like a big 45th Street building, right? We just know like that's the VA building. But like, what is it like, especially being a practitioner?
Yeah, I mean, I think for me, one thing for people who like either haven't spent a lot of time in that system or like just for the public to know is that the military veterans, they have their own culture. And so as a person who's providing care in that system, you have to go into it knowing they have their own slang, they have their way, you know, when they talk about their MOS or their DD-214, like it's just a whole nother language, a whole nother world, a whole nother culture. And even how we like communicate with people, knowing what their rank was, really helps you to understand a lot about kind of where that position was, because the military is such a hierarchical system that if you don't kind of understand that going into it, it can make it kind of a challenge where you practice in medicine there. And again, I think it because people who've been in the VA hospital system, and again, there's different cultures amongst, you know, like the Vietnam era veterans, very different culturally than an OIF, OEF, a person who is in Afghanistan, you know, so, and they're all in there receiving treatment. But as we know, like Vietnam and all the social and political things that were happening then, they're going to be very different than a younger veteran. But what I would say is, as a person practicing there, you have to understand the culture. You have to understand those generational differences when you're providing care, how the trauma was different at different times when you're providing care. But then also, like I said, these political, how the things flow. So for example, being there over 10 years, I would see like when administrations would change, where the priorities are, because that's where the money is going. Sometimes mental health, that's a huge part of somebody's platform is supporting veterans. Man, you'll see that money flowing in. I mean, really, you can see programs.
You'll notice like, oh, there's some money coming out.
Sorry to break your concentration. I know you're probably knee deep into today's episode, but do not forget, check out our Lunch and Learn community store, shop.drbarrypierre.com. Remember to use the code EMPOWER10 and make sure you are leaving us a 5-star review, especially on Apple Podcasts and Spotify. Thank you. Now back to your regularly scheduled podcast.
Whereas like in the last administration before now, there was a huge push toward care in the community. So from what I saw, unfortunately, and also that was part of why I think ultimately I made my transition is because what you see is a lot of resources going towards places outside of the VA that often aren't actually providing care at the level and standards that we were providing while we're underfunded. You know, so when you hear a lot of complaints about the VA and wait times and all that, it's like, well, the money is going toward paying someone on the outside and not staffing the people who are here or giving, you know, compensating them appropriately so people want to come here. How can the system really function adequately, you know?
That's interesting, and I appreciate the insight, because it was just one of those things where if you're on the outside kind of looking in, it's like, okay, I see how it kind of works. But then like you talk to those like, I gotta go to VA, I gotta get my meds from VA, everything is like VA and it's a system, and I gotta like, and then I have some of my veterans who are like, I am not going to that building, I want nothing to do with the building, and just like, but I thought y'all get everything for free. And but so I could definitely see how it could be two different worlds, just depending on who you are, when you go. Like, so that's definitely very interesting from that perspective there. So let's talk about this aspect of the non-clinical career, right? And especially for yourself, right? So after 2020, when you made your pivot, what was kind of your direction? Like, was it kind of like, all right, I'm here now, I'm gonna figure it out, or was something kind of pre-planned? What were you thinking, especially in that 2020 range?
So actually what happened is after 2020, after I left my academic position, I started doing full-time telemedicine. Again, thinking like, maybe it's just the setting that I'm providing care, maybe I'll like this new modality. So I did that from 2021 up until my transition last year. And even doing the full-time telemedicine, which of course is, for psychiatry, I feel like a pretty kind of more easier shift than some. I still felt like, no, this direct patient care is just not the direction I want my to go in. So really over the last couple of years, and honestly, it did take me about a year and a half to make the full transition because I made a lot of mistakes, which is why I'm glad we're talking, having this conversation for people who want to make a transition, because a lot of people are making it now and things can be more competitive. So kind of going into it, kind of understanding it. But really, I think over the 2 years, I really kind of wanted to give direct patient care like the last chance. And to me, switching to kind of telemedicine was that. And then really over that, you know, couple of years, I was like, okay, I know that I really want to be doing something different. That's really how I knew I wanted to kind of give it that final chance to do some, to be for sure, I really wanted to make the change.
And you kind of mentioned just mistakes now, especially back then, where it probably wasn't as in vogue, right, to want to do something different. Versus now, I feel like you kind of mentioned it. I feel like it's not necessarily more commonplace, but you're not necessarily looked at like, oh my God, what do you want to do? Like they don't really give you that ill of a look anymore when you decide, you know what, I don't really want to kind of go down this traditional route. Like, what were some of the mistakes that you felt that you made kind of over this past couple of years that you wish, if you could go back in time and say, man, if I could just do that again, I did this different, or went this way, or
Sure. One thing I wish I would have done just to start off is really to do more networking and really just to learn more about like the positions that are out there and what they really involve day to day. I mean, now I'm involved in like, Facebook groups and I have made those connections, but that would have actually saved me a lot of grief from like pursuing things that probably wouldn't be a good fit. Like for example, I was pursuing one position in pharma, but as I got to understand it, it involves a lot of travel and having like an elementary school age child that wouldn't have been a good fit. So I think about how much effort I put just because it sounded interesting. And I was like, oh, it says 20% travel, but really talking to people in there, they're like, that's the minimum, And so like just not really understanding that. I think really even start, I'm talking like very basic things like getting a non-clinical resume, very different from what we typically have clinically. People only want like a page or, two. And you know how when we typically do it academic-wise, we have everything. We have every publication.
We got publications, we got journals. I was published here.
Everything. Oh, but that's really in the corporate world, or as you make this transition, that's really not what people are interested in. They know you're a physician. They're going to respect you as a physician, like just going into it. So what they want to know is, what other skills do you have? Can you bring? What leadership skills do you have? What communication skills? So really understanding how to write that resume in the language, in the way that they understand. Even putting a lot of medical things on a non-clinical resume, these people aren't in medicine. It doesn't translate to them
So
what
they're
talking
not
about.
even computing with like, hold on, like,
No.
okay, I see what you put on here, but like, oh, like what? Like,
What does that mean to me? What does that mean for this position where we're not asking you to see patients? So I think just, and I knew it intellectually, but really, I mean, ultimately, I did pay to get some help. And probably I could have, should have done that investment early on.
This week's episode is brought to you by the Autism in Black Foundation, which is hosting the fourth annual Autism in Black Conference. This year's theme is Bridging the Gap, which is helping to celebrate our unique experiences, cultivating a community of understanding while building a brighter future together. Autism in Black Conference is designed by and for the Black autism community, centering on our needs, experiences, and aspirations. The conference looks to provide a safe and supportive space where Black individuals, families, professionals, and advocates can all come together to learn, share, and empower one another. For more information, including how to purchase tickets for the virtual conference, please check out drbarrypierre.com/AIB2024.
Now, was it a, and this is a question I always ask my physicians who kind of go that route, non-clinical. Was it difficult to say, you know what, I'm not going to see patients somewhere? How was that transition?
And for me, I'll honestly say the best thing to me about working in the VA system was working with veterans. I really truly do miss it. I love, and as particularly as the years went by, I started having more women patients, because the demographics of the military changed, and I really felt just like very needed.
Wow, that's a good
Despite
point.
what
Great.
people say about veterans, and in medicine, you hear about maybe there's entitlement and all this. I honestly felt that people truly felt appreciated by what I was providing. So I generally still miss it. I'm not even say I'm totally done with maybe clinical forever. But I think at that moment in time, I was like, I definitely want to reach out and do things different. But it was hard for me. And also I think I did feel like, because the VA is so mission oriented, like I really felt like what I was doing had a real purpose to it and that was really helping. And I can say I have that same kind of mission orientation in what I do now, the way that I did taking care of patients. It doesn't hit the same.
You know, it's interesting, especially in when I talk to a lot of my physician colleagues, especially in it's just funny. It's funny because I have to, as I speak, I have to get ready for like board certification again, which typically occurs 10 years after residency. And I'm talking to a lot of my colleagues now, and you know, they're starting to have these thoughts, right? We're like, man, like, all right, this 10 years is okay, but like, can I do this for another 10? Like, they're starting to have these questions of like, okay, what is that next kind of journey? And I like that you mentioned like you wish you would have networked, you wish you would have gotten groups and been in services. Because unfortunately, and I tell my non-medical folks all the time, one thing I think medical school does a disservice to us is that it really doesn't teach us how to network. Like, it teaches us how to study, teaches us how to get ready for the boards, take care of patient and everything, but like talk to each other, that's not really, like, it's not really a thing. So when we go out to these places, like we're floundering, not realizing that, like, oh, this I should actually get this person's card, or and not just get their card, but actually call them and follow up and do these things. So I always felt that we were always at a handicap when it came to just networking and just business discussion. Like you kind of mentioned the resume. Like I tell you, I gotta as you're talking, I'm like, oh, I wouldn't even know how to write a regular resume if I had to convert my own resume. I don't even, so that's my bad on me, y'all. So I'm just like light bulbs are hitting me as you're kind of going through the motions of like, oh yeah, you probably should kind of know this. And I think it hits more as I know that I've got a decade in the game. So boom, decade in the game. Like, all right, I did that 10 years, but like, all right, am I doing this for another 10, 15, 20? Or like, what is it going to look like? Is there going to be some pivot in the future?
Yeah, and I mean, I think the good question you talked about, like with the transition, really, again, especially I am as in psychiatry. So I think compared to, let's say, like a surgical specialty, where, as you know, you have to keep privileges and credentialing, you have to do so many procedures a year. I think if you're in a surgical specialty or one that involves procedures of any kind and you're making a clinical transition, you definitely need either coaching or networking, but someone to kind of help you really understand the implications of being out of clinical practice. I mean, that's true to a certain degree for all of us, but I think, like in psychiatry, for example, if you're not doing ECT or something other procedure, it's a little bit easier to kind of pivot, you know, from just people I know who've done that to go back into what we do, because we're not typically touching the patients, you know. So I feel like we can do that. But whereas if you are in a surgical specialty, you know, you really may not be able to get credentialed if you're, I think, out of it for a couple years. So there are some considerations depending on what your specialty is. And again, that's where also that networking and really having almost like a mentor in whatever your specialty is, as you make a transition, can be really helpful. That's where coaching can be helpful too, so you can really know, because I think you have to understand the implications of being out of clinical practice for, you know, extended periods of time.
Definitely. So this past year, and you kind of mentioned just some options. Like, what are some options for, you know, the physician who may be 5 years in, maybe 10 years in, hey, maybe a person who just finished residency and they just want to know, like, what are some options that I may be able to, like, just in case, like, what are some options that you kind of came across or had experience in?
Yeah, I think what we would call like a low-hanging fruit is going to be working for insurance companies and utilization management. So that's typically going to be involved, you know, essentially doing like chart review, peer-to-peer calls, you know, those annoying peer-to-peer calls that you get for medication or for procedures or something. And so typically if you're working on the insurance side, like I do, it's called utilization management. My title is behavioral health medical director. If you're working on the hospital side, you'll hear it more often called physician advisor. But typically that they're kind of, those are the people who are having those interactions. I say low-hanging fruit because for most of those positions, you have to be board certified, but you don't necessarily have to have any experience doing utilization management or chart review, however they describe it. So it can be a good entry point, you know, into, like I would say, the corporate world. That's again with the position that I'm doing. Can be very different. Again, I think this is also a place where really kind of talking to people. I mean, some people, I mean, as you know, like insurance is, it was probably a whole nother whole podcast about physicians and insurance. But you know, from my perspective, like someone has to do the role. And I think that I do it in a very like fair and just way. So if somebody has to be on the other end of the phone call, I'd rather it be someone like me compared to people who I've heard practice it a different way. But it has to be done. And I think that'll be an overarching theme for me for this whole conversation, which is that as physicians, we're needed in every aspect of the healthcare system. There are so many people making decisions on our behalf who do not have as much
Talk about
training
it.
as we have, or not as specialized as we have. They don't have as much leadership skill as we do. So it's important for us. So I would say essentially my day is sitting, I work from home full time. I sit in front of a computer. I look at charts. I probably do more peer-to-peer calls than I would say some of my colleagues who aren't in mental health, because for, you know, typical hospital stays, they're paid like a certain amount per diagnosis group. So, you know, if you have CHF, the hospital is going to get paid this amount. If you have a COPD exacerbation, mental health is different. It's paid per diem day by day. So we're much more likely to have people in the hospital, I would say, for a longer time, right? If the hospital's only going to get paid a certain amount, there's going to be some effort, right, to move people on
Oh
quickly.
yes. Oh yes. Hey, what's that? What's that? We call it DRG. Once that DRG hit, and that social worker is like, hey, Dr. Pierre, you know,
What's the next
it's
transition point? Mental health is a little different because, as you know, like with depression, for example, if someone's admitted to a psychiatric hospital, some people may have an acute stressor, maybe 3 or 4 days, really just to get a break from the stressor, get their medications tweaked a little bit, maybe enough. some people who are depressed need ECT. You know, they may be in the hospital for a month. So I feel like I think compared to my colleagues who don't do mental health, I feel like we have more peer calls because our stays are paid on a per diem basis, day by day. So again, and there also might be a little unconscious motivation, right? If you're getting paid day by day to do things to extend hospital stays. So
what I love about that is, and you kind of dropped a significant gem when you talk about we're needed, especially physicians, we're needed in all of the different areas. Whether it be on the insurance side, whether it be on the academic side, whether it be on the teaching side, whether it be on the, like, we're so sparse in these positions that when you have this bottleneck of us only doing clinical, of course you're going to have less experienced people in the positions that once we find out when we're doing clinical that are a little bit, I don't want to say higher than us, but from a decision-making standpoint could definitely make moves that we wish we could make, but we didn't all went to the clinical. So I do love that you dropped that gem, because I think that's a big one that I definitely want my medical students, residents, physicians who are listening. That's definitely something you need to, you know, put to the side for sure.
Yeah, I wish I had gotten that message just in my training and really got more exposure to it. But yeah, UM, I would say it's like the low hanging fruit of a transition. And then there's pharma and anything in the pharmaceutical industry. So I would say that's everything from doing like clinical research to medical affairs. Medical affairs is, I would say, like a more administrative role where you're kind of a liaison in a company. They can have a lot of different roles and things that they do. But like a physician, they usually call it medical affairs. I would say in pharma, though, I would say kind of lower barriers to entry typically are PIs, you know, principal investigators on studies, because a lot of times you're in a study, but you're doing like the clinical. So there still may be some clinical or clinical monitoring that you're doing. So a PI can be a kind of a jump to other places in pharma. Pharmacovigilance, that is basically where you are doing like monitoring for like drug reactions and like safety. So you hear it called drug safety positions. That's also a place where physicians have a lot of expertise and a good barrier, a less barrier to entry. And then I would say medical science liaison. Those are the people who, you know how we have the drug reps who come to the offices, but the medical science liaison is the person coming not with drugs, but just with the information. They're influencers. Sure. They're influencers. Yes. They don't have to be physicians. So again,
the medical science influencers.
The medical science liaison.
I didn't already call them an influencer. That's funny. Medical
science. Because I mean, that's how I think. Because you can't sell when you're in that position. You can't sell. You're there to really influence. And as you know, I mean, a physician talking to a physician, to me, it just has impact, right? So you'll see more physicians in those positions, but it doesn't have to be. So there is some competition from pharmacists. That's oftentimes who you'll see there. MPs a lot, some PAs are in those. But for physicians, that can definitely be a transition into pharma to kind of get in and kind of go other places. So there's everything in pharma. There's so much there. And then I would say what I call government jobs, those are jobs that are working for like the Federal Food and Drug Administration, the FDA, CMS, the Center for Medicaid and Medicare Services. All these like government agencies have physicians who are doing non-clinical, you know, roles. Even OIG, Office of Investigator General, especially in the VA, they, you know, investigate all these claims and things that happen or negative outcomes. They have physicians on that team. So if you're not familiar with USA Jobs, that's the federal government website for hiring, but you can go there and like search for medical officer to get an idea of what these non-clinical government jobs, they don't come up very often because when people get in them, I'm telling you, they stay in them.
Oh, they don't leave. It's like, oh, once I'm here. We're good.
Honestly, it took me forever to even understand about them. Someone kind of turned me on to, you know, something with the FDA when I was doing public health. And I was like, okay. And I was like, oh, this is what a physician would do, work for FDA. So just all types of government jobs, you know, public health, of course, you know, with the MPH, there's all like these medical directors for states and county health directors. So there really are a lot.
Does the public health degree help at all? Did it give you a little boost one way or the other?
I'm going to tell you it did, because particularly for utilization management, what I do for psychiatrists, they don't come over often just because of the nature of mental health and things go. Anyway, there's not a lot of physicians for it. And so I do think it gave me a competitive edge. I would say that a most of the people who I see transition now, a lot of insurer level type business degrees. I really do see that. I don't think that, I mean, I will say that in my position, it has come in handy a few times because people kind of see me as a policy go-to person, a person with experience in that area. So it's kind of helped me just kind of stand out of my current role. It's not necessary, except I'm saying a lot of people have it now. So, you know, if I'm doing screening, right, and I've gotten 50 applications, you know, it may help you get through that initial process, but it's
kind
not.
It stands out a little bit more like, okay, all right, MPH, MPH, MPH. Like,
I right. see. A lot more people have it, I would say, than I would, even when I started the process a couple years ago, it seems like a lot more physicians, even if they didn't have it like in a dual program, they're getting them later just to be more competitive.
What I just seen is just especially over, I always kind of hark back to what 2020 did for a lot of, especially colleagues just kind of, you know, in my class, is that they recognize that as a physician, like, okay, this, you know, this is where my worth is, right? Like I'm here. They've got me running, burning buildings and, you know, taking care of COVID patients during this severe pandemic. And, you know, once it kind of died down, like, oh, like the fanfare was gone. And they realized like, oh, like my onus was only highlighted because of this pandemic. But like right when it went back down, you guys went to, as if I wasn't, you know, okay to have discounts at all these restaurants and get early, like all of a sudden, all of those discounts and praises kind of went away. So I think they realized very quickly, like, oh, you know what? Being this physician stuff, like, yeah, it used to be great. It used to be great. Still great now. First of all, let me tell you, still great. But like, I need to start looking at other ventures because it took a pandemic for me to realize that, oh, this is where you're actually at on this totem pole in the grand scheme of things. And this is what your employer may actually think about you. Or this is like, it just opened up the eyes for a lot of people. I mean, I know I had people like they started getting into investing. They started doing real estate. They started doing everything outside of medicine because they're like, okay, I see what this medicine stuff right here is doing. And I don't, if another pandemic come through, I don't know if I'm going to do it again. And so like, these are just very serious questions that a lot of them are having. So I think this is such an important topic for them because they want to know that, hey, you know what? I don't have to see 30, 40 patients a day, right, to make a living. I don't have to, you know, work at a job for years. And then if something happens and then I get two, you know, and I always talk about the two email issue where like during the pandemic, you know, we had a doc who was there at the hospital 30 years. I mean, he opened the hospital. When the hospital opened up, he was one of the first docs there. He passed away. He got two emails. Hey, so-and-so passed away. Hey, this is a repat. And then we never heard about it again. And I was like, oh, you see, the business of medicine will move on without you very quickly. And they realized that, okay, I need to not be, you know, like in my 30th year, dedicating myself to a system, to a business that, you know, the second I'm done, they're just going to get the younger me right in place. So I that's why I think this conversation is so important because I think it should kind of open people's eyes up and say, hey, we can do more. And especially because I know I have a lot of people who might be afraid to do the more and feel like if I say non-clinical, that means that they have to go into real estate. Like, no, you can still stay in healthcare, right? You can still, you know, you can still, like, you can still be here. You can still use your degree, but you may not necessarily have to go see that patient or, you know, round and do. You may, again, I think there's options, and that's why I love this conversation we're having.
Yeah, and I think even when I was just initially starting my search, when I would just literally go look for like medical director on like Google or Indeed, I was surprised like Amazon had, you know, healthcare positions for physicians. Like the knowledge, we, I think, do not appreciate how much our skill set, how much our knowledge is valued. Even if we're doing consulting, I mean, I think honestly, we really get put in a, we get pigeonholed to say like, you see patients, that's what you do. And I think that also does us a disservice as residents, particularly not learning the business side of medicine. Like as we're learning how to practice and take care of patients, we need to understand how billing works. We do not need to really understand like RVU and all this stuff the first time when we're becoming an attendant. And unfortunately that really is too often
too
what
often.
Happens.
Too often. You read that contract and you're like, okay, I got to do what?
What does it mean? What does it translate to? What kind of work does that really mean for me? But I totally agree. I mean, I think just as you get older, probably just really kind of understanding and putting work in a certain priority. Again, I think we all are so driven for so long in patient care. And again, so we're mission oriented. I mean, I would say most physicians are going into it just generally want to make a difference. We want to help people. And we are taken advantage of because of that, because people know how dedicated we are. And even during the pandemic, you know, there were people who would stay not because they had to, but because they felt just an obligation
Oh, yeah.
to the patients. You know, even if they're like, forget this system, they're coworkers. I mean, that's who we're showing up for. But that's also we're taking advantage of because of that. You know, oh well, we don't pay for overtime for physicians because of this, or well, oh, you can't see this one more. And it's like, no. And I think just getting to a point where we can put that in perspective and really prioritize like where work belongs. Because like you said, you can pass away, you'll get two emails, the system is going to move forward. So then how should I position my work? You know, and for me, that has been a change. I mean, I would say that's been a huge change for me, just changing my mindset around it. Like, how do I position work and where do I put that now that I'm not seeing patients? Let me tell you, it's not at the top. You know, it's been easier for me, I think, to do that because I'm not seeing patients. It was much harder in clinic. You know, I'm opening emails on the weekend. I'm trying to get the paperwork done, you know, because that's what we do. But I think we have to recognize the system does take advantage of us with that, and we have to learn how to prioritize and put our work where we're going to put that.
Now, do you have, especially that you've kind of made the transition kind of where you're at now, do you have kind of a progression plan, or is it like, hey, I'm here now, I'm gonna see what I'm gonna do, you know, for a year, whatever the time frame is, and then maybe move on to something different, or like have you thought like in kind of that far out?
Yeah, I mean, I think it's really taken me, I feel like a year to really, because my year will be in April of this year. So I think it's really taken me this long just to feel like I'm very proficient at what my day-to-day job duties are. Since I've been there, we've had a lot of changes. They're, you know, super like in January, I started with a certain supervisor. He was gone by the end of the month. He put his resignation in, you know, so there's been and I think just in the way corporate works with restructuring and reorganization. For me, part of my adjustment has been being in the VA, even though it's federal government, so nothing's going to happen real fast. You know, change is going to happen. It's going to be 5 years from now. Whereas here, when they say something's happening, I mean it's moving, like it's going to happen. And so I think just getting adjusted to the culture. People, again, I feel like in the federal system, there's a lot more oversight. Like, what are you doing with your time and all this? Whereas people like, you're a physician, I trust you to get your work done. Like, nobody is monitoring me. And I love it. I'm like, wow, nobody's like trying to keep up with me in that way. So it's been just, so I think it's taken me about a year. But when I think about what my trajectory is, I think about really just mastering. There's other aspects of my job I do besides utilization review. So part of that is like quality management. So I don't think I really even really understood you could do this, but because maybe it's because I work for Medicare Advantage, but you can complain to your insurance company if you feel like your stay or there was something about your care that did not meet standards or you had a certain negative outcome. And I know people do it a legal route, but I guess I never thought about calling like Blue Cross or someone and like making a complaint, but you can. And
Yeah,
so
I can tell you from a hospitalist perspective, when that typically occurs is they like if you're trying to discharge somebody, and they say, hold on, discharge, I ain't ready to go, and then they make the call, and all of a sudden my discharge don't happen.
I have not, I guess again, because I've been in the VA, we have a very complicated other kind of complaint system, but it doesn't work this way. So I've kind of been learning about it. But I will tell you, and it's even heartbreaking sometimes to see, because I think when you're a provider who's providing care at the standard, at a minimum, and often above the standard, we do not realize how much just inappropriate care is happening, how much dangerous things are happening, like lack of supervision. So like some of the cases I've seen, typically I get referred the cases that either happen in a psychiatric hospital, whether it's psychiatric or not, or something, you know, involving a typical psychiatric issue, like, you know, a death or, you know, someone being harmed, or something of that nature. And to see what people are doing, I mean, it has opened my eyes. And so I think that's kind of another element to the work that I do. And so again, I feel like for me at this point, I'm trying to really just become proficient in like all areas because that's been a little bit of a new kind of role. Now that I've been in the role a little while and I'm getting quality management cases for Medicare and Medicaid now that I work with. So kind of navigating this. So I kind of, for me, I'm like, okay, I feel like I'm still learning. I feel like my growth is still is like it's expanding. So I feel like I'm comfortable here. I think if I got to a place where I felt more stagnant, I think I'm just a person who kind of likes stimulation. So if I got to a place where I didn't see a growth, I
You need to
probably would be
grow, you
thinking
mean
like, yeah, what's the next step?
like I'm about to know. Now, of course, you know, obviously we follow each other on TikTok, right? So, and I'm always a fan of my healthcare colleagues who get on social media. Especially because I just think we're at a time where we have to be on there. I hate to say it, like we just have to be on there. There's just so much misinformation that if just like you kind of mentioned how we kind of downplay our level of expertise because we assume that you know people will be truthful or people will say the right things that we don't need to get on there. There's a lot of unscrupulous people out here just that like carry lies. So I just love seeing my healthcare workers get on here and just kind of spit their information. Say, hey, this is what I know. This is what I know. This is what I do. So I did want to definitely before we got you out of here, give you a shout out. And say we appreciate you for being on social media because I know I have a lot of physician colleagues who just will not touch it, even though I'd be begging them to come on.
I know. And I think that's also what motivates me to be there. I think particularly there's so much stigma around mental health. There's so many people who I think just make themselves de facto mental health clinicians. They're like, oh, I feel like I can do this. And
Ooh-wee.
which that's probably true in all the medicine, as you know. But
Yeah,
I
but the
think
mental health, they on there kind of crazy. The mental health folks. Are the folks who extrapolate
who
the mental health
believe.
folks?
And it's dangerous and it's harming people. And I think that's what draws me to it. I think when people just get out here and start talking, they don't realize what kind of influence they could have. They don't, I think, or maybe they do, I'm not sure, but there are people who are listening who will stop taking medication, who will do all these things just because they heard a sort of credible person or a person they could relate to. And that's why also I try to make my content just like relatable, like when I'm walking, when I'm doing this, because I think sometimes there's like a barrier, you know. Sometimes that white coat kind of presents a barrier. So I think for people to see us like, I'm a normal person, but I do have this information and I'm here trying to, you know, give you something that's evidence-based. That's what I say. When it's my opinion, I'll give that. But when we're talking about evidence-based information, it's like, yeah, I want you to have that, not just someone who got on the internet one day.
And because they be on there talking so confidently that I'd be like, oh, who's this? And I go look, you know, me, because that's what I do. I'm like, oh, I start clicking. I'm like, all right, looking for bios. Like, okay, hold on, what is this person doing? I was like,
No
oh no, you can't be.
credential.
You know, I can't find a credential, nowhere to be found. But the way they're talking, and then I'm looking at they're answering comments like that. I'm like, okay, I gotta say something. This is getting but it there's so many of them. And we're on TikTok, but I'm on like YouTube. I'm on LinkedIn, even be wilding sometimes. Like all social media platforms, there are just groups of people who will take it upon themselves to, you know, just expound upon information that I know they don't know what they're actually saying. And I'm just like, oh man, someone who watches you is gonna actually take what you're saying and follow through with it. And if someone like me doesn't at least say, hey, guys, please, like, let's be, you know, a little bit more judicious with, you know, who we take. And I tell people all the time, like, even if you hear me say something, I want you to go to try to fact check me, right? Because you may say, I don't know, where did this guy might have just picked up a white coat somewhere. I don't, yeah, he called himself Dr. Barry, but he might be lying. I want you to be just as diligent in getting your information because I know some of y'all are just taking some of this information and just kind of running with it,
I've
right?
heard you say that. I've heard you actually say like, I think you post an article. I've heard you say, you're like, go check,
Go
go
chat.
see.
I'm like, please, just like, don't listen to me. I'll show you how to get said articles so then you can read yourself. And if you got questions, we can. But it's definitely a struggle, right? But it's definitely one of those things where, again, as physician who's thinking about doing things that may not necessarily include, you know, seeing patients on a day-to-day basis, right? You know, just being on social media, being an educator, you know, speaking, all like there's so many different options that I want our colleagues to understand because I don't want y'all just leaving with your expertise, right? Like I didn't go to residency with you. I didn't see your clients with you. I didn't publish those journals with you. So if you leave and you leave your expertise and you don't go to the insurance companies, you don't go to the pharmaceutical companies, you don't go into government, you don't go into academics, if you don't do those things, like the brain drain, like unfortunately continues.
Love it. I can say it even better. We need that expertise in all of these places. Even if you wanted to become And let's say you want to be a politician.
Yeah.
We know what just happened in Alabama with people who are in the legislature making decisions about healthcare decisions who clearly don't understand anything about.
I was gonna talk about it on TikTok, but I got a bad sinus infection. I couldn't talk nothing. I said, okay. I said, but it's ridiculous. Ridiculous.
Right. But take that expertise. I love how you said it. Don't just leave with it. And I mean, there's nothing wrong with real estate or investing. That's fine too. But if you can find a way to keep your expertise in one of these systems we interact with, I mean, to me, it's just amazing. We need to be there.
So before we let you go, I want to make sure people can find you, follow you, right? If you got any game for them that you want before you to spit on them before you leave, like please do so. Again, I appreciate this conversation. I think it's a conversation that medical students need to have, medical residents need to have, attendings who fresh out need to have, attendings who are 10 years in, like your boy, need to have. It's just a continued conversation because I just don't want, I hate to see us leave because we're dejected with the system because we went the traditional route and we say, you know what? I'm done with medicine in general. I'm out of here. And then you'll go off and do golfing or something. I don't
Well, I am Psych Doc Dooley on TikTok, Instagram, on YouTube. My website is leannedooley.com. So, again, I'm out here trying to crush some stigma related to mental health. That's kind of what my focus is right now.
I appreciate you. Thank you again for joining the Medicine Mondays and Lunch and Learn show.
Yeah, thank you for having me.
Thank you for getting to the end of the episode. I am yours truly, Dr. Barry Pierre, favorite board certified internist. Like always, remember to subscribe to the podcast, leave us a 5-star review, and more importantly, share this to at least 2 of the 5 of your friends and family members that you know that could be empowered with the words that you heard today. Again, so appreciative of all you guys' support. See you guys next week.